Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
This is the Donalana Kitchen. We get together around this table once a week at our wonderful community radio station, KHOI. And this is a volunteer organization. It's a community organization. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
Yes, they do, and we do. Thank you for their help. And this is the Thanksgiving time of year. Happy holidays, everybody.
Here we go.
Yes.
Food time.
Food time. Well, what else do we talk? We talk about lots of other things, too, on this show, but it's so nice to have this time of year where the harvest is in, we're celebrating around our table, and now we think about food and sharing it with others.
It is a very creative time.
It is. Talking about turkey and lots of other birds, too. You might say this show is about holidays most foul. Yes, it is. We are going to be considering lots of different sort of ways that we can celebrate and the fixings and all that.
F-O-W-L. Okay.
There we go. Yeah. Joining us in the studio today is somebody that knows about fowls and birds, and he's not only a good cook, but he likes to hunt the little fellers, too. And welcome to our table, Nick Odey.
Thanks for having me on.
Good. Nick Odey comes to us from Practical Farmers of Iowa. He's their communications director, and he does a lot of other good things. He has a show here on this very own radio station called
On Farm, Conversations with Practical Farmers of Iowa.
Great.
And when does it air?
It is on Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. And you can also find it as a podcast on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts.
There you go. You can download on your device and find out more about the On Farm radio show. The Donalana Kitchen radio show is also available on the KHOI-FM website. It is streamed, but it is also archived. Lots of good things there, khoifm.org. Well, like I said, Nick Odey knows about birds. He knows how to cook them, and he knows how to hunt them and procure them. Yes, he does. What kind of birds are we going to be talking about today?
Well, I guess this year, so far, I've done a decent amount of duck hunting, pheasant hunting, goose hunting, turkey hunting in the spring. We typically hunt turkeys in the spring in Iowa. There is a fall season, but most of the turkeys that are shot in Iowa are shot in the spring.
Why is that?
That's the traditional time to hunt turkeys, and it's a lot easier to hunt them in the spring. And because you're only hunting males in the spring, essentially, it doesn't affect the population. So you're not like stealing eggs or shooting females on nests.
Okay, so how do you hunt? You wait till they're all strutting around, and you shoot the one that opens his tail up? Is that how it works?
It's a little more challenging than that. Turkeys are one of the most wary animals, so they get a reputation for being stupid, which in some ways I won't argue with that. They have this tendency to, especially domestic turkeys, to just all of a sudden die, like get trapped in a corner or freeze to death by standing out in the rain when there's easily accessible shelter. But wild turkeys are really wary. They have a really acute sense of sight, so they're able to see any type of motion. So that makes hunting them really challenging. And so in the spring, typically what people do are go out early in the morning, listen for the males to gobble, and that's how you locate them. A lot of times you...
Thank you,
exactly.
Donna. Thank you. Thank you.
And then find where the males are gobbling. So they roost in trees at night. And so you're trying to go out there in the early morning to find where they are roosted, and then get as close to them as you can without them seeing you. And of course, again, they can see really well, so that becomes a little challenging.
Do they sleep at night? Can you shoot them up at night?
Nope. you can only shoot during daylight. So it's a half hour. The shooting time for turkeys is a half hour before sunrise to sunset. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, that's really early. You get out there really early, and then you try to keep track of them as they fly down off the roost, and then imitate the hen call to try to get them to come in. Because it's breeding season, they're trying to find a mate, et cetera.
Can you do a hen call?
I typically use what's called a slate call, which is basically a piece of rock, and then a little thing to hit the slate so it makes it sound like a hen call. But in general, it's like a yelp, 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 yelp. Uh-huh.
Very good.
And sometimes if they're so close that they would be able to see you call that, a lot of times I'll try to imitate that mouth call, or there's actually a call that fits into your mouth that you can call with. It's called a diaphragm call, but you put it on top of your mouth and it enables you to make that sound a little more effectively if you can't make the sound with your mouth.
And this is effective. I mean, they do kind of take notice.
Sometimes it's effective, and sometimes they ignore you and go elsewhere. They're notoriously fickle. They're really hard to predict. You can kind of get into understanding their patterns, and then one day they stop following the patterns, and there's no apparent reason why. So they're really actually a pretty challenging bird to hunt, and it takes a lot of practice and a lot of kind of understanding different things that they do.
So unless you hear them, you won't know which one is a male?
And actually that's a good point. In the spring, you can only shoot birds that have a beard. It comes out of the center of the chest, and it's a kind of stubby, bristly little beard, a few inches long.
Do you use binoculars to see?
So when they get close enough to shoot, you can see their beard, and that's the end identification. You have to make sure that they have a beard. So it's a bearded bird or a male, and males typically their head is going to be brighter colored, kind of some blue or red, really bright red, and even white on top sometimes. And of course, if you see the bird gobbling, you know that it's a male. But the law states that it's a bearded bird or a male. And so at the end of the day, the beard is the 100% I know that I can take this bird. There are bearded hens, but it's kind of less common. But a bearded hen is a legal bird to take in that season.
A bearded hen.
Genetic
variant?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's just I suppose it has something to do with hormones, but yeah, there's certainly.
And how close do you have to be to see the beard and to shoot it?
So shooting range, probably within 50 yards. So you're taking these birds with a shotgun. And so this is shot. So the shot spreads out at distance. So at a distance, it's going to be less effective. But most of the birds that I shoot are within 20 yards, I'd say. 50 yards is probably about the max, maybe 60. But it's probably most of the high-quality shots are pretty close.
Ah, turkeys. Oh, yes. And do people hunt turkeys with bows?
Yes, they do, and that's another challenge because, as I said before,
movement.
They have a really, really good sense of eyesight, and so pulling the bow is extremely difficult. And so most people that hunt turkeys with bows hunt out of blinds on the ground so that they can see. But then there's other limitations of that. You can't move around as easily to position yourself. And because of that, the bow season is a little bit you get a longer amount of time to take a turkey with a bow than you do with a shotgun. The season, the time frame opens up a little bit.
Now, did you grew up in a hunting family, so
yep.
You learned all this from your dad.
I learned
it from his dad. Who learned it from his?
Well, I learned everything that I know about hunting from my dad, but his dad didn't hunt. So he pretty much learned most of what he knows from just going out there and trying, reading, other friends, mm-hmm. I mean, things like that. So, and turkey hunting specifically, the Iowa turkey season only goes back to about 1980, I think. So before that, there wouldn't have been any turkey hunting experience in Iowa because the last turkey taken in Iowa legally previous to that would have been in the 19th century.
So they were in decline or something for a while?
They were almost extinct.
Oh.
And in fact, they were extirpated from Iowa. And then through the efforts of the Iowa DNR starting probably in the late 60s and early 70s, I think the mid 70s, they started reintroducing birds primarily, I think, from birds from southern Missouri, if I have that right.
Mm-hmm.
So the genetics were fairly similar mm-hmm. to what they would have been naturally in Iowa. And they've
bucked to the numbers. Did we overhunt them? Is that how we started to lose them?
It would have been a mixture of overhunting and habitat decline.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if we look back around the turn of the century, we'll see that we had even less trees than we do now because of grazing and kind of just a more expansive. There was a lot of people on the landscape using a lot of the different resources, and then hunting in the spring. But the best resource for information on that is a book called A Country So Full of Game, by Jim Dinsmore. He used to be a professor at Iowa State.
Uh-huh.
And that book really details the decline and the resurgence of most of the game species in Iowa. And turkey is one of the ones that's mentioned there.
Well, now that you hunt it, then what do you do?
So as far as like the butchery process?
Well, you have to butcher it and mm-hmm. pluck it and
yep.
then cook it.
Yeah, so I've plucked a number of turkeys. I've plucked one turkey, but usually I skin turkeys. They're a little like pheasants that the skin on a wild turkey is pretty thin and there's not a lot of fat mm-hmm. on a wild turkey. So it doesn't gain you much from a culinary perspective, I guess, to pluck the bird. Unlike ducks, where it gains you a lot.
Yeah, because the fat is there.
Because the fat's what you're after.
Oh, yes. Let's talk about ducks and others. Ducks and geese. Donna said that she hadn't heard a lot of geese. I've heard geese flying over. How have your duck and goose hunting been going?
So I'm more of a duck hunter than I am a goose hunter. Take some kind of...
What kind of ducks?
Mallards is always the mainstay, just because they're bigger. They have more fat. They're like, I mean, for one mallard, it's a good chunk of meat. But lots of other duck species migrate through, and we hunt them all. There's kind of two classes of ducks, diving ducks and dabbling ducks. And dabbling ducks are the one you might see just tipped upside down, and they have their butt up in the air, and they're just eating things that are close to the surface. And diving ducks are ones that will dive several feet or several yards down to the bottom of a water body to eat.
So which kind is a mallard?
So a mallard's a dabbling duck. They eat primarily invertebrate insects in the water, but they eat a lot of grain. They eat a lot of corn, but they also eat a lot of essentially what farmers would consider weeds, things like barnyard grass, things like smart weeds. Those produce a lot of grain that's good for mallard diets. And so when that emerges on in wetlands during dry periods and then it floods, that's kind of like their best scenario.
You say ducks. Well, for one thing, you are hunting in wetlands, which is not easy walking all the time. I mean, it's hard to get to. So, and ducks dive, ducks fly. I bet a dog comes in handy.
Yeah, definitely. So so we always had dogs growing up. And then I hunted ducks for several years after I moved away from home without a dog. And there's a number of reasons why that's difficult, mainly because when you knock down a duck and it's not dead, it's difficult to find. Like you say, they can dive, they can get – it's easy for them to get away, and a dog just makes that – I mean, that's what retrievers are for. I mean, especially Labrador retrievers are literally were bred for that purpose.
For ducks. And I always thought it fascinating that, well – they're such good dogs to start with, but they go through high water and weeds and swim in icy cold water, and they bring it back and they give it to you without much of a fuss.
Right.
Yes. That's good. Do you use calls for ducks too?
Yeah, so ducks and geese, we have calls. They can be made out of a number of different materials. Traditionally, they would have been made out of wood. Now a lot of them are made out of some kind of a plastic, and yeah, it's a whole art. There's a world duck calling championship. And I remember there's a guy in Southeast Iowa who won it. And I remember hearing about that.
He's
a Mississippi River duck hunter.
And what about decoys?
Yeah. So
I see him at the auction a lot.
Yeah, duck decoys are a big thing. So when you're hunting ducks, ducks are coming from overhead. So you have to do something to attract their attention, and decoys are kind of the number one old tried and true way. Again, they used
to
be carved from wood.
So they see what they think is another duck, and then they go, oh, well, if he must know what he's doing, right?
Yep, and kind of go down and take a look. And kind of a big revolution in duck hunting within the last 25 years, I suppose. When I was a kid, it just started to come on the market as spinning wing decoys. And so that creates the appearance from the air of that little white flash. And from the air, that's really, really – that stands out a lot, that white flash. And what it looks like is a duck that's about to land. And so when those first came on the market, the people who had them had a huge competitive advantage on, like, big areas where there's lots of different people hunting. And now it's kind of evened out because everyone has them.
So that's because the ducks have that – like turkeys, that sight sensitivity?
Yeah, so all birds have pretty good sight. Yeah. Turkeys especially, I think, because they have ground predators, so they're used to other things coming at them from the ground.
A little bit wary, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, ducks, so their eyes are catching the attention of what they perceive to be ducks down there, and then that either movement of the decoys or that wing flash really gets their attention. So
I haven't eaten that many ducks or geese or wild turkeys, but I do know that ducks have amazing amount of fat on them.
Yummy.
And
fat.
That's what is so good about them. Does that make plucking them, preparing them a challenge?
Yeah, so ducks, in most cases, I always try to pluck them.
How long does it take to pluck a duck?
Depends on the size. It depends on the size because, a big, a large Canada goose that we're talking about, like 10, 11 pounds, mm-hmm. easily take an hour and a half. A green-winged teal, who, it's going to be like, very long, less than a foot long, could pluck one in 10 minutes, 10, 15 minutes. So it varies a lot. The way to kind of expedite that process is I rough pluck it, just take the outside feathers and leave the down on the inside, and then dip it in hot wax. And then when that wax cools, it adheres to that those feathers, and then you can just break the wax off, and it comes off super clean, cleaner than you could ever
get. That's like shaving your legs, I think.
Exactly.
Well, actually, yes. In the few ducks that I have anything to do with, I remember the down being a real dickens to deal with, all these little pin feathers. And the wax does work. And you can reuse the wax?
Yeah, exactly. So
like paraffin wax.
Yep. Yeah, the same wax that you'd use for canning that you would have been historically using for canning. In fact, that's where you find the wax in a grocery store is in the canning section. But, yeah, you can kind of strain the feathers back out and reuse it if you can figure that out.
Oh, and good. What about the singeing techniques? You don't advise those?
I do that sometimes. So if I pluck the duck by hand, then sometimes it's easy to singe, like, as a final step.
Now, for plucking a duck or a wild bird, is it the same as you would for a chicken? You put it in boiling water quickly and then pull it out?
For ducks, I don't do that. Just dry pluck it.
Oh.
And I think ducks hold their feathers differently than chickens do. So I don't think that'd help you.
They're used to being in water all the time anyway, right? Yeah, there you go. Yeah. But do you have any favorite ways to cook these wonderful things?
Yeah, and talk about the flavor. That's the most important thing.
Flavor.
The flavor differences between wild and cultivated, say, geese or ducks
So I don't eat a lot of domestic ducks or geese, but I will say that the flavor in wild ducks varies dramatically by species and by what they're eating. So if you have a duck that's been eating a lot of, like, fish or invertebrates, that some of those flavors that we perceive as off flavors come through in the meat, which it really comes through in the fat. So a lot of times,
so fishy flavored fat.
Exactly. So a lot of times on those type of ducks, that for one reason or another we know that we can skin the duck and remove the fat, so we're not eating that fishy flavored fat, because the meat doesn't vary nearly as much as the fat. But in general, wild ducks have just it's a lot more variety of flavor. So you have opportunities for really, really good flavors and really, really strong that you might not like flavors.
So you never know what you're getting.
So you can kind of think about when you're hunting them. So, like, if I went out and I was shooting mallards right now, I can pretty much be assured that they're eating corn. And it's pretty good. I mean, you can think about duck kind of like you'd think about beef. It's going to be similar to a corn-fed steak. It's red meat. It's got fat kind of interlaced with each bite. And so corn-fed mallards are pretty good. So are, for example, if a mallard's been gorging on barnyard grass, wild millet, or smartweed, or something like that, it's also going to be really good. It's typically the insect and the kind of fishy-ish things that we think of as off flavors.
It's amazing the variety that's out there and all the good taste that we can have. So
what does a Canadian goose taste like?
Yeah, I mean, Canada geese are similar. I mean, you can kind of think about them as big ducks. I don't really think of them. I don't really see that there's a lot of difference in flavor. It's just that their size means that you need to consider differently how you're going to cook them.
Well, now I'm trying to imagine a bird that has flown as many miles as a Canadian goose does. How are they not tough?
Well, so if you think about a lot of the large Canada geese actually probably fly a lot less than a lot of the ducks because they're raised locally. So some geese and some ducks are raised on the tundra and then are flying all the way to the Gulf of Mexico or South America. So they are flying a lot. Other ducks might be raised locally and shot locally. Wild ducks are certainly going to be tougher than domestic ducks. And accordingly, their meat is going to have more flavor, because it has more time to develop that tone. It's like an older animal versus a younger animal when it comes to domestic animals.
So cooking, you must use some sorts of braising, more wet methods, right?
Yeah, so the way that we always had duck growing up was roasted. Stuff it with apples or sauerkraut and roast it in the oven with a little bit of wine or juice or something at 350 for a couple hours. The legs were always falling apart and delicious. A lot of times the breast gets dried out when you do that. Duck in general, and since I've experimented with a lot of different things and read a lot about ducks, in general now I try to never cook the breast meat past medium rare. Because I just think about it as like a steak, and you'd never cook a steak past medium rare. So
right, because then it toughens up.
Right, and the same thing happens to duck. It's red meat. It's got fat. But the legs are you can think about as like a brisket. You know, you can cook those to falling apart, and they taste really good because
they
have connective tissue.
So what are you doing, cutting them up and then cooking the different parts separately?
Yeah, so you can do it a number of different ways. If you know a duck is a young duck, actually, eating the legs at medium rare works too, and so we do that a lot. So grilling the whole duck, really high heat for a short amount of time works pretty good.
And but how can you tell how old the bird is?
Oh, it's that gets a little bit tricky, but there's some feather identifiers that you can look at to see if it's an immature bird or not. But in general, so we go up to North Dakota every year and hunt ducks in northwest North Dakota where there's a lot of ducks raised. So just as a percentage, you're shooting more young ducks because you're shooting them at the start of the migration, and so there's more young ducks around. But regardless, it is a little tricky to know what's a young duck and what's not. I break a lot of the ducks down. Basically, I quarter them, take the breasts off of the keel. I'd say 75% of my ducks, I pluck it all, leave all the skin on, take the breasts off the keel, and then quarter the wings and legs out, and then save the carcass for stock. And then all those little parts, I'm going to braise. And you can, you know, there's a number of different ways that you can do that. You can confit them in fat. You can braise them. You can sous vide them. I mean, there's a number of different ways that you can do it. But in general, you can think of those legs and wings as low and slow things.
Very good.
Sounds
very
yummy.
Good. We're talking to Nick Odie about birds for the table. This is KHOI. This is Donalana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. This is the holiday season. That was a little banjo tune. Home sweet home. Yes, some of us are headed there, and some of us are gathering other folks into our home. With us today is Nick Odie. We've been talking about birds, and he's got something he'd like to share with you.
This is a poem a little bit about fowl, but about other things too. Wild Geese by Mary Oliver. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about your despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things.
Thank you, Nick. That was Wild Geese by Mary Oliver. We're talking pheasants, we're talking turkey, we're talking ducks, goose, and we're going to be talking about some of the things that go with such things. Donna, what are you planning for this upcoming?
Well, you know, here's the thing about Thanksgiving. It's sort of a set menu. There are definite expectations. Turkey, obviously, you know, cranberries, mashed potatoes, pumpkin pie, that sort of thing. So every year I try to take some of the traditional ingredients and do a little tweak. So it's the traditional ingredient, but by golly, it's going to taste just a tiny bit different. So I have two tweaks that I'm doing this year, and it has to do with the mashed potatoes. And first of all, I'm gonna read a little bit. There's an article I came across that tells exactly the perfect way to make mashed potatoes. And there are a few rules, apparently. So this is from a chef called Barbie. Chef Barbie. I've forgotten where she's from. Anyway, here's her name. Barbie Marshall. She's in a radio show, television show, Hell's Kitchen's All-Stars or something like that. Anyway, I found it on the internet and I went, you know what? This makes sense. So here are some of her potato opinions. Number one, the russets are to be used only in the worst quick case scenarios, if you have nothing else. Red bliss potatoes and waxy potatoes are for making smashed potatoes, not mashed potatoes. And she says, as far as using fingerling potatoes, no, I would agree with that. It's a waste of time. First of all, you have to peel them. Her best bet is Yukon Gold, which I am in total agreement with, although I have to say I have used russets and they work just fine. But Yukon Gold is the best choice simply because it has the most rich flavor. So she says there are a few things that she does. Of course, you have to scrub and peel. Her main insistence is that you must start the potatoes in cold water.
Ah, never have.
Yes, because, let's see, what does she say? There's a reason for it. It's something about the way the salt, the way the potatoes don't cook evenly unless you start them all in cold water, and something about the way they release their starches.
Ha!
Which makes sense, because you can mashed potatoes can be gummy, like never use a food processor to mash them, right? Or they can be lumpy, which means you have not quite cooked them all the way through. So the basic thing is to just make sure that all the potatoes are relatively even in size so that they're all cooking at the same thing, and start them all at the same time in cold water. So that's pretty, and then she pours, salted water, of course. And she pours the water off, and then she also recommends, which doesn't hurt, to warm the milk and cream before as you're mixing it in.
Good idea.
So there you go. That's pretty straightforward stuff. So my little trick this year that I'm going to do to the potatoes is I'm going to add a celery root, but not too much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I would say I'm trying to guess proportions. I usually maybe 5 to 7 volume of potatoes to just one celery root.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want it to be too pronounced. You just peel it up and throw it in and cook it with the potatoes.
Ah.
And that gives you just a little bit of a slightly different flavor profile.
Oh,
so
yes.
That's the one trick. The other trick that I'm going to use this year, which I got from the Ensign Mills website, they're always doing some marvelous things, is I'm going to add Madeira to the gravy.
Oh, good. Now, you don't want to add it. You add it soon or way at the last, or doesn't it matter?
Well, the Ensign Mills recipe was, for my mind, a little bit fussy because I guess I'm old school enough. I'm going to take the pan drippings.
Oh, of course.
She wanted you to make stock in advance and have it ready and have it all velvet smooth. And I don't strain my gravy. I don't, you know, I like the little crusty bits in it and all of that sort of thing. So I'm just going to, how I usually make it is, you know, you take the turkey out and somebody's over there carving it and I'm in the pot, adding enough flour to get it, you know, to make the roux.
Yep.
And then you start adding in the milk and or cream and salt and pepper. And that's when I'll put the sherry in.
Ah, sounds good.
Or into the roux or something. You don't put enough Madeira in to curdle it in any sort of way.
Ah.
But I think it's going to be really unctuous.
Sounds good. Go with the traditional, but always tweak it a little bit. We can always... If you're so inclined.
Absolutely.
Oh, something else that always comes to mind this time of year is cranberries.
Oh, yes. And Lana and I have... This is Lana's discovery, and I have to say I've done it for the last 3 years, and I really appreciate it.
And this can be found on the Donna Lana Kitchen website, khoifm.org. You can find the Donna Lana page there. We have recipes. We actually write some of this stuff down. This is horseradish cranberry relish.
It's easy. It's yum.
I originally got this recipe from National Public Radio reporter Susan Stanberg, who used to read it on the air every year at Thanksgiving. And after you hear it year after year, you think, well, I should try that. And I did, and I do it every year ever since. You take cranberries, a small onion, sugar, sour cream, and 2 tablespoons, at least, I suggest more, of prepared horseradish. Grind the cranberries and onions, fold in everything else.
Are you using the food processor?
Yes. Yeah, food processor. Yeah. So it ends up pink. That's good. Pink is good. Fold in the other ingredients.
No, you don't cook anything.
Don't cook anything. No, raw, raw, raw.
It's all raw.
Put the mixture in. This is important. Put it in a covered container and freeze it overnight because the freezing actually breaks things down, mm-hmm, mixes the mm-hmm. flavors. 2 hours before you want to eat it, take it out of the freezer and let it thaw. It should be cool but not mushy. Stir it lightly and put it into a pretty dish. Don't just plop a Tupperware container on your Thanksgiving table.
Good heavens, no.
That recipe is available on our website.
We have two pumpkin pie sort of recipes. One is a cobbler, which is the recipe I usually make, and then Lana has a Provençal. Should you be inclined to tweak your pumpkin recipes?
Yeah, so look that up,
too. Furthermore, I recommend using kabocha squash or buttercup squash instead of canned pumpkin or any pumpkin because they are a tad bit richer. They taste and look like pumpkin, but they're better.
Really good. Really good.
I think most of the pumpkin pie canned is actually butternut squash anyway.
Yes, you're right. It is. It's a certain variety of butternut squash that I believe the Libby Company is famous for having grown mostly in Illinois, as a matter of fact.
And this time of year, we always trust those little cans of the pumpkin.
Well, they're easy. That's for sure.
That's okay. That's fine. So
better than no homemade pumpkin pie.
Yes.
Right.
Pumpkin pie. Speaking of traditions, there's this tune that pops up as part of Americana, eh? It's called Turkey in the Straw, and I always had some questions about Turkey in the Straw, okay? But what is this in the straw thing? My friend in Eastern Iowa, she used to say, how do you get turkeys in straws? They're way too big. You'd never thread them into a straw that way. No. Okay. All right. Found out Turkey in the Straw has been an American folk song for a long time, back in the 19th century. It is related, and other tunes sound like this, originally from a ballad called My Grandmother Lived in Yonder Little Green. Oh, that sounds good. It's also very similar to a dance tune called The Old Rose Tree. But the modern version, if you hear someone singing it, it's always got this line that says, roll them up, twist them up on high, tuck-a-haw. And what the heck is a tuck-a-haw? Now, you look up in Wikipedia and you can actually find out what a tuck-a-haw is. I thought it just meant a good high time, but no. A tuck-a-haw, a tuck-a-haw, is a green arrow arum. It's a plant, an edible wetland plant with long petioles. So heaven knows why. Maybe the turkeys go into this thing. I don't know. Hi, tuck-a-haws. And twist them up a tune called Turkey in the Straw.
Does that mean they're eating?
I don't know. They're probably all these ducks and turkeys in there. That's what a tuck-a-haw is. It's a plant. There's a lot of different versions because you get people fiddling and playing banjos. They make up all kinds of things. And in the Civil War, and actually before the Civil War, it was a song that showed up a lot in black minstrel shows. Unfortunately, the song gave rise to the blackface minstrel character called Zip Coon, and there were many Zip Coon Turkey in the Straw verses. For better or for worse, that is our heritage. So let's celebrate fowl. This is KHOI. You're listening to the Donalana Kitchen. Happy Turkey Day, folks. Welcome back. This is Donalana Kitchen. We're talking Turkey Day. Duck, duck. Yeah. Ducks and goose and turkey and all kinds of things. Oh, Donna, you're so good at that. I want to remind you that this is community radio, and we get by with help from all of you. Not only your monetary memberships and all kinds of help you give us that way. But you can actually come down here and volunteer. There's always things to be done. You could be on the radio, too. It's a surprise. We never thought we'd be on the radio, but here we are. There's always room for help. Always room for help. So if you want to support this radio station, you can call 292-2878, and a real live person will talk to you. Or you can go to khoifm.org, and there is a magic donate button there. Yes, there is. And you could also just plain old show up here, 410 Douglas, underneath the resplendent Amos Pantorium sign. We are in the old dry cleaners building, and we're a fun bunch of people. So you can come and stop and see what's going on here. We've had lots of help from people during this fun drive.
Yes, we've had a lot of local businesses have really stepped up to the plate here, and KHOI would like to thank the following sponsors of the KHOI 2017 Fall Membership Drive, and those businesses are Morning Bell Coffee Roasters, the Ames Chamber of Commerce, the Greater Iowa Credit Union, Mary Greeley Medical Center, Alluvial Brewing Company, and the Mucky Duck Pub. Thank you.
This is the season of thankfulness, and we'll be heading off to our Thanksgiving dinners later this week. So, what are you looking forward to on your Thanksgiving table, Nick?
Well, one of the things that I think is probably different from most Thanksgiving tables, although they probably have buns in some capacity on the table or rolls, but we have Grandma Odie's buns is one of the things that always is on our table. In it,
where did Grandma Odie hail from?
East Central Iowa, kind of over Keystone, mm-hmm. Iowa. So, and it includes some potato, mashed potatoes, and potato. The water that you cook the mashed potatoes in.
Yes.
So some of the starch has gotten out into that water, and you add that starch to the
Is it a yeasted bun. Bread?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And you add some yeast to it, but that starch gives it that just velvety. Mm-hmm. And we always have lots of those, and then they're great for leftover turkey sandwiches.
Is Grandma Odie still making them?
Nope. She passed away a few years ago, and we've carried on the tradition.
Who's making it then?
Oh, I make them sometimes. My mom makes them sometimes. And usually I make them some other times of the year, but you have all that potato water at Thanksgiving time, so.
Good. That's a good thing. I like it. Everybody has interesting traditions. Jell-O shows up a lot. I haven't had Jell-O.
Are you going to make a Jell-O this year?
No, I
have gelatin in the past. Mold?
I have in the past, but I'm not going to this year. I went to a friend of mine Thanksgiving many years ago. She was from Texas, and this thing was the thing you had to have was green Jell-O with pecans in it.
Oh, I think I'll skip that one.
Well, but it was there. It was kind of there. It was part of the family. See, just so that was a good thing. I like that.
We always have strawberry Jell-O too.
Ah, see, and anything in it?
It's strawberries. Trunked strawberries and Jell-O.
Mm-hmm.
I also like the version that's got crushed up pretzels and some whipped cream on top, or probably cool whip. You know.
Yeah, Cool Whip shows up.
But Nick, you could reconstruct this with all natural ingredients. You know, you can make your own Jell-O without using the Jell-O brand, and put strawberries in and put real whipped cream on it.
You could. We've done an all local Thanksgiving a few years in the past, and it's fun.
Yeah.
Doesn't taste the same, but it's fun.
Oh, no, it doesn't taste the same. Sometimes that's a good thing.
But there's something about tradition. There's something about tradition. Here's a few thoughts on the frenzy of the holidays here. Well, we have Thanksgiving. It is the most generous of holidays. There's really no ceremony. We don't have to give gifts or anything. It's just devoted to hospitality and love. So, but after.
And
after,
it's non-denominational.
Yeah, it is. But after, we tend to get a little crazy because we're on the downhill slide to Christmas and there's all this shopping that goes on. So think of this. And this is a traditional thing that we can glom onto now. The next day is usually called Black Friday. But There is also another tradition that is starting to grow. It's called Buy Nothing Day. And this is where we can really shine by staying home. It kind of is something to do instead.
So we're opting out of the commercialness.
Yeah, we can. At least on Friday, think of actually buying nothing. Eat leftovers. Wear old clothes, sort through your collections of stuff, and see what you don't need. And
recycle.
Maybe you can give something away. It's a challenge, but you can do it. Can you actually get your mind around Buy Nothing Day? Yes. Let's kind of work at this overconsumption stuff.
I do want to note that the Black Friday phenomena is within some of us, it's a new phenomena.
It is.
I mean, we didn't have that when I was growing up.
No, it's funny about that. It's everybody gets a little crazy. So think about Buy Nothing Day. Practice. You can do that.
It's a political statement, I believe.
It is. And also, on Saturday is Small Business Saturday, a time to celebrate your local business.
Right, that would be Buy Local Day,
Buy local. Actually, it is an invention of one of the big credit card companies, but you don't have to use a credit card. Just think of all those nice local businesses. You can do that. That's good. We want to thank Nick Odie for being with us today. And there's Thanksgiving coming up. Celebrate without shopping after the
if you can.
Holidays. You can do that. Yeah.
And resist that.
There's a tradition actually that happens around Chicago, but it's happening in other parts of the country. It's another tradition called Breaking Up Thanksgiving, and that's for musicians and dancers all over. It was the Friday and Saturday and the whole weekend after Thanksgiving. Take all your leftovers and dance it down, yeah. It was Breaking Up Thanksgiving by celebrating with a good barn dance.
Oh, and so you get more exercise after you've eaten all of that.
Yeah, dance and play music, yes. There is a barn dance on Saturday. That's kind of a tradition here in Central Iowa. Central Iowa Barn Dance has a barn dance. You can go to centraliowabarndance.org. There'll be Calling by Roger Alexander, music by Nate Kemperman, and friends from coming up from Missouri for that. That's a good thing to do.
And where is it?
It is at the CASA building, which is in Campus Town, south of the Dunkin' Donuts. Find the Dunkin' Donuts and go south, yes. There'll be a fiddling pig at the door. Not a real one. There'll be a fiddling pig cut out of wood. There's a sign there.
I would show up to see a fiddling pig.
Okay. So good. So have yourself a good Thanksgiving.
Yes, and remember to be thankful. Yeah. That is the point of the day.
As we all
practice gratitude.
You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We had special guest Nick Odie. We've been considering holidays most foul. Yes, we have. Yes, we have lots of birds, lots of opportunities for good food. You've heard banjo music from a collection called the Stelling Collection. And also, we'll go out with a fine tune by Tom McKenzie. This is an original tune called the 4 o'clock Waltz. So get those turkeys thawed out and think about how you're going to fix them. I always take a bit more fuss than you would think. And support this fine radio station. Listen to the Donalana Kitchen on KHOIFM.org. And remember to support this radio station by pledging, becoming a member. Also, with the holiday season coming up, think of giving a membership to this fine radio station to someone that you really like, or maybe even someone you don't like at all, because won't they be surprised when they open up that little gift there and it says membership to KHOI, support your local radio station. And we've got mugs, we got t-shirts, we got all that kind of stuff. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.